fasten your seatbelt and turn up the radio. We're going on a road trip. Welcome to Route 51, regional talk radio for North Central Wisconsin. I'm Glenn Mobrick. Today on Route 51, our focus is on the man from Marshfield, Melvin Laird, Defense Secretary under President Richard Nixon, longtime U.S. Representative from the 7th Congressional District, and the youngest person ever elected to the Wisconsin State Senate. Laird is one of the most important figures in American politics during the 20th century, a figure who brought the Vietnam War to a close, ended the draft, helped build the intellectual foundation for the modern Republican Party, played an instrumental role in the fields of healthcare and medical research, and helped create local institutions like the Laird Center in Marshfield and the Central Wisconsin Regional Airport. Joining us today by telephone from Washington, Dale Van Atta, who has written an impressive and compelling biography titled With Honor, Melvin Laird in War, Peace, and Politics. And here in our Wausau studio, Bob Williams of Idea Associates, longtime Republican activist from Stevens Point and one of Laird's personal friends. Now, as always, we invite you to join the conversation at 261-6371. That's 261-6371 or toll free at 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742. And if you want to get in line, our lines are open right now. And I know a lot of people have a lot of stories that they'd like to share about Melvin Laird. First of all, Dale Van Atta, thanks for joining us for this hour. Why did you choose to write this book on Melvin Laird? Why did you find him a fascinating choice for a book like this?
There are a lot of reasons, Glenn, but one of the most interesting to me is a longtime investigative reporter and used to write a column with Jack Anderson. I was surprised the more I delved into it how much influence he was able to have without getting credit for it. It was a very personal reason as well. I'm a baby boomer, and the draft lottery that he instituted saved me from going to Vietnam. And because he withdrew troops so quickly, he saved a lot of lives of baby boomers and obviously their future children.
A lot of people appreciate the fact that he ended the draft, but he still and Nixon is getting criticism for not ending that war quickly enough.
It does take time, and it will take time for the next Secretary of Defense in January, whoever wins the election. And the reason is because you have to leave behind some semblance of the order of what you built up. And for Mel, it was starting the program of Vietnamization, which took 3 to 4 years to turn over all the fighting, all the equipment and everything else to South Vietnamese so they could do it themselves. I mean, it must have taken months. It almost took a year to translate all the manuals for spare parts and how you take care of the aircraft and the artillery rounds and so on into Vietnamese. So these kind of things take time, and they did succeed for a couple years, even without funding from us.
So that's something to keep in mind as we move into another administration, no matter who is there and how quickly they want to end the war in Iraq. It's something that can't be done overnight.
Yeah, and you have to, the next secretary, you have to build a coalition among all the competing interests. Most Americans don't necessarily understand, if Mel comes in 1969, he's not just debating and fighting with, in a sense, Henry Kissinger and Richard Nixon, because they don't want to go as fast as he does, but also the Joint Chiefs, who may have thought they could still win it at that point, and then all the different services with all their different interests, and then Capitol Hill and the anti-war protesters. I mean, it was a far more complex situation that he was dealing with, but there are a lot of hidden interests as well, even with this Iraq program that's going on. So it will take a little time.
Bob Williams, what do you think of Dale Van Atta's book? I couldn't put it down.
Well, I found it a great read, and I'm with you. And I just talked to a friend in Wausau, Mark Bradley, today, who we gave a copy to, and he had the same thing. He can't go to his bed at night. He's reading it. I found it true because I lived so much of that period with Mel, because I had worked with and for him since 1954.
Is that when 1954? Is that when you met Bob? When you met Mel?
Yeah, Bob Froehlke of your town, when he was in our town then with Century as an attorney, and he introduced me to him, and that was consequently 4 years later after volunteer work, they hired me to work with Mel in a campaign.
And Mel, in 1954, had just been elected to Congress, or...
No, Mel in 54.
He was still in the state senate.
He's running for a second term.
Second term, okay.
Yeah. Well, all right.
His influence is still felt in Stevens Point, Bob. We have the Laird Youth Leadership Day every day at UW-Stevens Point. That's something he started back in 1958. And it's still an institution, and we were there at this year's event, and we're going to play a short news clip for you right now. This is the Melvin Laird Youth Leadership Day at UW-Stevens Point about 4 or 5 weeks ago.
On Wisconsin. Thank you.
Governor Jim Doyle led a bipartisan group of the state's top political leaders. He told hundreds of high school students that the former Republican congressman and U.S. Defense Secretary represented what is good in politics.
The way that Melvin Laird has approached leadership, he always did it with a twinkle in his eye, with good humor, and with friendship.
Laird is the subject of a newly released, critically acclaimed biography. His longtime friend, assistant, and confidant, John Dressendorfer, says the Marshfield native's pragmatism is sorely needed today.
The whole is always better than the sum of its parts. So if everybody works together, and there are different solutions to different problems, but let's find the best solution, and how do we solve the problems?
Will Young, a sophomore at Three Lakes High School, says it's easy for young people to be discouraged when politicians don't find solutions.
Kids tend to vote just once, and then they don't believe that they can make much of a difference. But if more people start thinking, well, maybe this one vote can change something, maybe the right person will be elected.
But Governor Doyle says he's encouraged that young people are finally getting involved in the country's political life.
What we've seen in this country over the last 9 months is just extraordinary. The turnouts have broken all kinds of records. The youth turnout has been phenomenal.
Melvin Laird was unable to attend this year's conference for medical reasons. In Stevens Point, I'm Glenn Moberg for Wisconsin Public Radio News.
Bob, how is Mel doing?
Mel is doing exceedingly better. He was in a hospital in Fort Myers, Florida, where he lives. Challenged the service there. They were not what you have at St. Joseph's in Marshfield. And he came up to Marshfield, maybe 6 weeks ago. He is in so much better shape and up and walking around. It's terrific.
Did it occur to you back in 1958 when we had the first Laird Youth Leadership Day at UW-Stevens Point that here we'd be doing that? 40 years later, 50 years later?
No, and many of his opposition, some Democrats said, the minute he's out of office, that will end, and it did not, as you know. And I think your audience right today out there are many, many young people who are now 56 or 60 years old who went to that Laird Youth Leadership at UW-Stevens Point, where they take over 300 kids every year from 70 high schools. They get four from each high school, and they come in and they meet the most stimulating faculty.
Dale Van Atta, we heard Governor Jim Doyle, a Democrat, praising Mel Laird, the Republican, for his spirit of bipartisanship. That's something that rings true in your book as well.
Yes, it's kind of a critical thing, and it was kind of neat to hear Governor Doyle say it, because one of the scenes in the book that you've read, Glenn, is on the big moratorium day in November 1969, when there was 700,000 anti-war protesters in Washington, the most that's ever been there against the government, and Nixon was kind of holed up in the White House. Mel sent a couple of his people out to check out what was going on, and then he met with the protesters, two of whom were Jim and Jessica Doyle. Jessica is his niece, and they explained their concerns to him. He was always willing to listen. He was always willing to debate, and you just don't see that as much anymore, and it's hurting our government.
Now, when he was in Congress, he used his this bipartisan spirit to good effect on the issue of health care. He worked with a Democratic congressman, John Fogerty, from Rhode Island, to create the National Institute of Health, the Center for Disease Control, 12 regional cancer centers, and also the National Library of Medicine. We often think of Mel Laird in terms of this hard-nosed approach he had to defense policy, but we overlook what he did for health care in America.
Well, health care was where his heart was, and having come back from World War II, serving in the Pacific with the Navy, deciding he wanted to go into politics to do some good, he was convinced by the doctors of the Marshfield Clinic, the place that he loved, that the best thing he could do was work in the health field. So right away, he tried to get on the Health Appropriations Subcommittee, and he got on it. And he eventually became the ranking member, so the highest Republican on it. And so he was working with the Democratic chairman of that subcommittee. And year after year, they would double or triple whatever the president sent down for the NIH and the CDC. He just felt, when we're talking about saving lives, as I was earlier, countless thousands or tens of thousands by various breakthroughs that occurred because of the budgeting money they gave over the objections of people in their own parties and their presidents.
And, Dale, you remember because you wrote it, he said to President Kennedy, who, as you know, was trying to put a man on the moon and succeeded. And Mel said, I'd rather spend congressional monies on saving the life of one child through medical research than putting a man on the moon.
Yes, and regarding, even though he was on the Defense Appropriations Committee, that's a good point, Bob. He also was saying, I would much rather be fighting disease than any other enemies.
And that certainly paid off locally in Wisconsin. We have the McArdle Cancer Research Center at UW-Madison and the Melvin Laird Center for Medical Research at the Marshfield Clinic. But it really did change the whole landscape for healthcare in America.
Yes, it did, with regional centers everywhere and just the difference, because the NIH is mostly a grant-making organization, so the difference of the money that they were able to send out to the top medical researchers at the different universities across the country, including some of the best who are in Wisconsin, made a huge difference in the health research of the nation.
And Dale, as you remember, and you wrote again, he was three presidents, two of them Democrats, put him as the U.S. representative to the World Health Organization in Geneva, Switzerland, while he was there because of his knowledge, his interest, and his acclaim for the work he did in health care in the United States.
We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to talk to Dale Van Atta and Bob Williams about Melvin Laird's early days in Marshfield and how those experiences molded the man who later became one of the most influential figures in American politics. I'm Glenn Mulberg. This is Route 51, regional talk radio for North Central Wisconsin on the Ideas Network.
Contributors to Wisconsin Public Radio include attorney Paul A. Sturgill, serving the legal needs of the elderly and their families throughout Wisconsin and Michigan's Upper Peninsula. Toll-free information is at 888-613-0600.
For more information on regional programming for North Central Wisconsin, here at Wisconsin Public Radio, or to have your community event listed with us, check out our local website at wpr.org/WLBL.
The businesses, professionals, and organizations that support Wisconsin Public Radio's programming play an important part in our financial health. When you visit a WPR sponsor, please let them know that you appreciate their support of this station. Thanks very much.
If you just tuned in, we're talking about Melvin Laird, a new biography on the man from Marshfield called With Honor. We have the man who wrote that, Dale Van Atta, with us via telephone from Washington, D.C., and also longtime Laird associate Bob Williams, who's here in the studio. Dale, tell us about the influence of Laird's father, Melvin Laird Sr.
Well, he was a Presbyterian minister who taught him, he felt, ethics, morality, and more importantly, Mel drummed it into me when we were doing hundreds of interviews, left him a good name when he unexpectedly died in 1946. He was a leading light, one of the leaders of Marshfield, and then went to the state senate. So when he died, Mel ran for his state senate seat without needing to change the names on the signs or any of the posters, because his father's name was also Melvin Robert Laird.
One of the things that I find interesting about your book is the description of the interaction between father and son. Laird Sr. was a Presbyterian minister, but he encouraged his son to think for himself, even to the point of questioning some of his father's beliefs about God and religion.
That's an excellent point, Glenn. Yes, his father understood that the best thing to do was give his son enough freedom, though he set the rules there, enough freedom to think for himself, and was convinced he would come back, even if he left for a little while from religion or whatever else, that he would come back to those basic tenets. But Mel never really left. Mel did the same thing with his kids. I mean, you have a son who actually marched in the anti-war protests, and it didn't upset Mel at all. Nixon and Kissinger tried to give him a hard time about it. He was going up at Eau Claire Is that the way you say that?
Sorry. Eau Claire.
He was going to university up there and was protesting. All his children, all three, were against the war, but they had healthy conversations and healthy debates about it.
Now, speaking of Mel Laird's religious influence, Mel Laird Jr. would later be instrumental in adding the words "Under God" to the Pledge of Allegiance and making "In God We Trust" the national motto back in the early 50s. And what I find interesting is that while he was doing this, in the book he was visited by a man who would later become a longtime friend, Robert Baldwin, a founder of the American Civil Liberties Union, who had some problems with Mel introducing religion into the state motto. But nonetheless, they became good friends after that.
They did. Mel was always able to make friends with people of different points of view, and they trusted and appreciated him. I mean, one of his other good friends that you wouldn't expect for a Republican was George Meany, head of organized labor at the time. So Mel was really able to reach across.
And Dale, he made friends within the Congress that way, too, and that's why he got so much accomplished. And one of his best friends, everybody around here knows, was Senator Gaylord Nelson. And the two of those would back and forth on the Senate floor. Mel headed the Senate for the Republicans, Gaylord for the Democrats, back and forth arguing. They'd go across the street to the Park Hotel bar and restaurant, have a few drinks together, and make laws for Wisconsin. We don't do that anymore. Mel taught them something they have forgotten.
No, it needs to be done in Wisconsin and in Washington now.
We're talking about Melvin Laird, a new biography with honor. We have the author Dale Van Atta, and we have Bob Williams, a longtime Republican activist and a friend of Melvin Laird. If you'd like to join us, our phone numbers are 261-6371, 261-6371, or 1-800-780-9742. That's toll-free, 1-800-780-9742. Well, as a youngster, the young Laird was quite an entrepreneur, Dale, selling vegetables door-to-door and then taking a cut of the profits.
Yeah, it was very interesting to me that he could have made a lot of money if he had not become a congressman and then Secretary of Defense, because he was always doing those entrepreneurial things. I remember a story that with the high school there that I think was the basketball tournament, and he was pretty sure they were going to go to state, so he booked a room or two at the hotel where it would be played, and then he rented out that room when indeed they did go to state. When he went to college, he headed a cooperative that made him some money during those years. He had a real knack for it, and so I think it's to the Wisconsinites' benefit and certainly to Americans generally that he wasn't siphoned off early into business as he could have been, instead the public good.
He was also pretty shrewd in campaigning when he was running for his first state Senate seat. Dale, you tell the story of how he was campaigning in Marshfield, and he told an audience that he had to leave to get to an important meeting in Port Edwards.
That's one of my favorite stories. Mel, one of the things that made him so different, and we need more of it today, wasn't just the bipartisanship. He had a wonderful sense of humor. He loved practical jokes, and he thought he just wanted to pull one on his opponent. His opponent was also there. And so when Bob Froehlich told me that Mel made up this meeting at this other place that he'd have to go to and then drove down the road and they sat at a place and said, "Watch, in a minute, so-and-so will be coming down the road and he'll go to Stevens Point or wherever they were going to go to
Port try Edwards, to find, the other side of the district.
Yes, try to find out what speech or what meeting he should be at. But he also had, one of the stories I think that's in there as well, amazing heart. When he was getting, he often got two-thirds of the vote, even though it was a Democratic district, and he was a Republican. And once a Democrat was persuaded to run against him, a double amputee that he respected, and promised that he would become the postmaster for a town there if he ran against Mel. And he said some pretty tough things during that campaign year that were pretty negative about Mel. Nevertheless, when Mel won, he knew what this man had been after and felt he was an honorable veteran amputee, so he quietly went behind the scenes and made sure he became a postmaster.
Let's go to the phones right now. We've got Julie in Plover on the line. Hello, Julie. You've got a story of Melvin Laird helping with a GI loan.
Yes, talking about Mel Laird's heart, my mother often tells the story of the time that she and my father wanted to buy their first home. This would have been in 1963 or 64. and he was a vet from the Navy, and they applied for a GI loan, and it seemed to, for them, the story goes, it took a very long time, weeks and weeks and weeks, and they didn't hear a thing about this loan application, and someone told them to go ahead and write to Mel Laird, and maybe he could help. Well, apparently it took less than a week for the letter to get to Mr. Laird and for him to respond to my parents, saying congratulations on the receipt of your GI loan and becoming a brand new homeowner. And they contribute their getting a new home to him. And that's the story I hear all the time about the heart of Mel Laird.
He was a Wisconsin. He loved the members of his district through and through. And I really think the saddest day for him was the day he was forced, his appointment was forced to be Secretary of Defense. He wanted to continue representing the folks in the 7th District there.
Yeah, well, that's a wonderful story, and I love hearing more and more about him. He was a mythological feature in our home when I was growing up.
He still is.
That's
still
great.
Is. Julie, thanks so much for the phone call, 261-6371, 261-6371, or 1-800-780-9742 if you'd like to join the conversation.
Julie's story is a metaphor, really, for Mel's service. I was amazed at the people that would come up and say, you did this for me, Mel, you did that for me, Mel, and he had this great memory, has this great memory. I was with him in Waupaca at the vets housing there in Waupaca, Wisconsin, and a lady said to him, Mel, my grandson has won a scholarship to Lawrence University. 2 years later, we were back. The woman was there. He walked up to her and said, now your grandson's a sophomore. How is he doing at Lawrence? I looked at him. I said, Mel, have you seen that woman since 2 years? Well, no. How do you do that? Well, just memory. I have three daughters and I can't even remember their names.
That's quite a story, you know, and that's the kind of politician he was, and it's one reason why people in his district kept electing him by 62-65% margins year after year. In fact, I think in 1962 it was a young Dave Obie running for state senate at the time admits that he voted for Melvin Laird.
And went door-to-door with pamphlets.
Well, that was when he was younger, before he changed party affiliation. We're going to have to take a short break. We will be back with Dale Van Atta, who's written a great new book about the man from Marshfield, Melvin Laird, and Bob Williams. 261-6371, 1-800-780-9742. If you'd like to join the conversation, this is Route 51 Regional Talk Radio. I'm Glenn Moberg, back after this.
Wisconsin Public Radio is a service of the Wisconsin Educational Communications Board and the University of Wisconsin Extension, with additional financial support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and from listeners through the Wisconsin Public Radio Association.
We are back on Route 51, Regional Talk Radio for North Central Wisconsin on the Ideas Network. I'm Glenn Moberg. Our focus today is the man from Marshfield, Melvin Laird, and we have with us from Washington, D.C., Dale Van Atta, who has written a compelling and informative and an exhaustive biography called With Honor. Also joining us today is Bob Williams, a longtime Melvin Laird associate and friend, who first met the man from Marshfield back in 1954. And Bob, you wanted to add something to a story that we told in the first segment about Mel being shrewd enough to rent a hotel room down in Madison during the basketball playoffs.
And then sell it at a little higher cost than he paid for it. But the reason he rented that room is he knew Marshfield was going to go to the state tournament because his good friend Bob Froehlke was the star guard on that team. And the team went to this tournament, and unfortunately it lost by 1 point in the final game. Froehlke couldn't hold it together for them, I guess. But the gist of the story is many years later, Mel Laird chose him to be his Secretary of the Army when Mel was Secretary of Defense, and Bob moved to Washington from where he'd been President of Century Insurance, moved to Washington, and there was Secretary of the Army reporting only to Mel Laird. Isn't that...
There you go. And again, if you'd like to join the conversation, if you've got a story about Mel Laird or a question for our panel, 261-6371, or toll free 1-800-780-9742. That's 780-9742. Dale, when Mel was a very young man, he was impressed by a visiting admiral, John McCain Sr., who would later share drinks with him during his service in World War II.
Yes, he saw him in his Navy uniform. He was related to one of the store owners in Marshfield, and he just thought, I really want to be in the Navy if I can wear something like that. And, yeah, in the middle of that great conflict, he did share drinks with them, and that McCain association continued in a significant way because the man who was over the Vietnam War, in a sense. You had the president, you had the Joint Chiefs of Staff, but under the Joint Chiefs, it was the Admiral John McCain, who was the son of the person that he met, but the father of the current presidential mm-hmm. candidate, who was over the war in Vietnam. It was General Westmoreland reported to him. So, and it's very significant that this man, his son was taken as a POW while he was running the war.
So Melvin Laird has known three generations of John McCain, and I think it's kind of interesting that he started a movement, if you will, when he was Defense Secretary, the Go Public campaign to help the POWs who were being held in North Vietnam at the time.
Yes, there are a number.
And we have reestablished our contact with Dale Van Atta. Boy, that was a close one, Dale.
Yes, it was, Glenn. I was talking away, and I thought it sounds like dead air.
And, well, dead air is not a good thing in radio, and I'm
nope.
glad we've got you back again. If you've just joined us, we're talking to Dale Van Atta, who has written a great biography of Melvin Laird called With Honor. And we have a caller on the line who would like us to say something about Melvin's mother. We talked about his father earlier, Helen Connor Laird.
I don't necessarily want to quantify it, but there are some who may say that his mother had a much greater influence on him than his father, and he would never say that. But, of course, his father died when he was quite young, in 1946. His mother had a tremendous influence on him and was pretty substantial in her own right. In fact, there's been a biography written on her prior to his. She was a woman trustee of the University of Wisconsin and did some amazing things in her own right. And she was just an amazing woman who, you know, also, like his father, taught him to speak his own mind, which she felt she should be able to do as well. So he had to have a phone installed at the Pentagon when he was Secretary of Defense just for his mom's calls. And one of my favorite stories is the day that she called, and it wasn't a political conversation. He put her on speaker, and it was a time when he had his huge staff there meeting with him, and she started to tell him about this beautiful cardinal that was sitting out on a tree in her backyard and talking about the beauty of life. And he listened for 10 or 15 minutes, enjoyed it thoroughly, and then he said he had to go.
Well, I'll tell you something, Dale. I'm a bird watcher, and I can understand that.
Yes, and it kind of it helped his staff keep perspective. It showed him where his values were. You shouldn't be so caught up in your job that you don't remember why you're doing what you're doing. And the reason you're doing it is for family and country.
Now, Melvin Laird, as we were talking before the break, was impressed by John McCain Sr. He worked with John McCain Jr., and of course he knows the man running for president. And I mentioned the Go Public campaign when we got disconnected there to help POWs by pushing Vietnam to stop torturing the prisoners and treat them better. How effective was that?
It was very effective, and to help listeners understand, the prior to that time, there were two things that were not being done. The POWs were not being mentioned by the Johnson administration, and no troops were being withdrawn. In fact, when he came in, there was a request for another 200,000 troops. The reason for both is that, and the reason that it might not change is that Nixon and Kissinger felt that they did not want to withdraw troops because they wanted to have strong negotiations with the North Vietnamese, and they did not want to mention the POWs or the torture they were going through because then they knew it would become part of the peace negotiations, and they didn't want them to be part of it. Mel just instinctively, with those Wisconsin roots that he had, those progressive roots, thought, you know, let's not let them get away with it anymore. He called a press conference without asking permission from the president, had the POW wives around him, and told the North Vietnamese to stop violating Geneva Conventions. They still did some torture after that, but conditions definitely improved. And more POWs lived because of those changed conditions after his June 69 conference. And then a year later came the Son Tay raid, which also what turned out to be an empty POW camp in North Vietnam. But because of that raid, conditions also improved. North Vietnamese thought, we got to treat these POWs better than we have been.
Dale, before we go on, Dale, I'd like you to tell the audience the story of why a cocktail napkin was so important to Mel's life, but even more important to the nation's life.
Well, Glenn, is it okay if I do that?
Yeah, you're getting a little bit ahead of me, but that's okay.
That's what I figured. I was following your train of thought, and I knew you were getting
there.
No,
let's get into it, because we're down to our last 15 minutes
okay.
here.
Okay. Mel truly did not want to stop being a congressman. That's what he loved. He wanted to serve in Congress another 20 or 30 years and serving Wisconsin and the country as by serving the Wisconsinites. But because during the campaign in 1968, he was a friend of Nixon's, and he helped him select cabinet officers, and he talked him into selecting as a Secretary of Defense a well-known, hard, conservative Democratic senator, Henry Scoop Jackson from Washington. And Jackson said he would become Secretary if it was agreed by the governor, the Republican governor of Washington, that his replacement in the Senate would be a Democrat like himself. Well, Mel brokered that extraordinary deal, but then...
It would have been a bipartisan cabinet during a time of war, which would have helped Richard Nixon and the entire country incredibly.
It would have helped incredibly, and that was why Mel talked Nixon into it. It was a great idea. But then Kennedy talked... Ted Kennedy, that was so much in the news these days, at a conference in Hawaii, we're talking about December 68, talked Jackson out of the commitment he had already made. By telling him to, you know, stand up for the Democratic Party, don't join
so
the
suddenly
Republicans.
Nixon's got no defense secretary.
Suddenly he's got no defense secretary, and in a couple days he had already announced he was going to announce all his cabinet secretaries at once. They'd all be in the same front page New York Times picture. So as he's flying back from a Republican Governors Association meeting in Palm Springs, California, it's just Mel and him and a couple others on a plane, and he tells Mel, "You got me into this, and it's a hell of a mess, and you're going to get me out of it by becoming defense secretary." Mel kept saying no, and then he finally figured out the only way I can get out of this is by setting a condition that Nixon can't agree to. The condition I'll set is that I get to pick every one of my people. And the Pentagon is this huge pot. I mean, talk about a trough for political operatives to be paid off for all the work they've done for their candidates.
Incredible part of the budget.
It is. And that's why very rarely has a defense secretary been able to choose his own deputy secretary, because it's a big appointment for the president to pay off one of his political supporters. So it's just full of these political appointees. He thought Nixon wouldn't agree, but Nixon agreed. And Mel finally said, well, you know, I want it in writing. And they had been having some drinks at that point. And Nixon finally wrote it on a cocktail napkin that was under one of the drinks they had, that he promised, he pledged, you can pick all your own people, I can't demand anyone. And Mel had that cocktail napkin in his pocket for a couple of years. Anytime somebody at the White House said, the president wants this person there, he said, well, I'll look at him, but if he doesn't fit for us, I have this pledge.
And he was able to accomplish all that he accomplished as defense secretary, probably because he had so much power.
It was a huge thing, because then you have all the loyalty of all those people. You're the one that's appointed them, not the president.
How did he get along with Henry Kissinger? He was, Mel Laird was a defense secretary. Kissinger was the national security advisor. Laird worked well with Congress. Kissinger had the ear of the president.
From day one, there's no question that Henry Kissinger wanted power and had a substantial ego. Mel saw it right away, and Mel wasn't upset with it, because he was the one who suggested to Nixon that Kissinger become National Security Advisor. He had known Kissinger before Nixon did. Because they generally had the same views about the Soviet Union and many other things, conservative views, regarding defense policy, he was fine with it. He knew it'd be a tussle. He knew there'd be a competition. But he was fine with that, too, as we've kind of pointed out previously. But once Kissinger really tried to make some inroads, like saying in the first year, we're not going to withdraw one American soldier from Vietnam, Mel really fought and won. Time and again in that first year, one of the most extraordinary things, we might have been in a second Korean War in 69 if Mel hadn't talked the president and Kissinger into not retaliating to when they shot down one of our planes that was flying in their territory. So they had a competitive relationship. There were a lot of pranks they played on each other, but there was a lot of serious work going on. And on the important things where Mel opposed him, Mel won. But for the most part, they were in agreement when it came to arms control and other things. It was a fascinating relationship.
Bob? They did tussle a lot, Kissinger and Mel. But Mel says in your book, the executive branch of the Nixon administration would not have survived without Mel Laird. That was a Kissinger, tribute to the guy that he had really disagreed with many times in the Nixon administration.
One of the reasons I wanted to do the book is that in Nixon and Kissinger's memoirs, of course, they want to brag about themselves and say they created the world. So we were missing Mel's point of view. So he's in their books, but not in the rightful place that he should have been. Because the truth is, he was the only person in the whole administration they were both afraid of, going against him. Even though he was a cabinet secretary, President Nixon and Henry Kissinger did not begin to have the friends that Mel had on Capitol Hill or in the press. So they knew any time they went against something he wanted to do, especially if it was something that he felt was reasonable, there might be a story in the press or a resolution in Congress that would prevent them from doing what they wanted to do. So it was vexing. But then, for more initiatives than not, they needed that congressional liaison. They needed him to get a lot of their initiatives through on Capitol Hill. Mel never lost a vote.
In 1968, Laird was at the Republican convention. To back up just a bit, before he became defense secretary, he privately opposed Nixon's choice of Spiro Agnew as vice president, but he was enough of a party loyalist so that he simply, I guess, walked off the convention floor when the vote came up and didn't make a speech. But in your book, Dale, you mention him meeting a young person on his payroll named Hillary Rodham, who was there as a Rockefeller supporter. Rodham later helps Laird write a speech critical of the Vietnam War effort, and apparently Mel Laird stayed friends with her even after she switched parties and became a Democrat.
Yes, and became
did.
Hillary Clinton.
Yes, he did, and still is to this day. Her home was in the very conservative Henry Hyde district in Illinois, so she was raised as a Republican, but she was going to Wellesley at the time, and was already converting to the Democratic Party. So kind of as a last-ditch thing, she got this internship with the Republican Conference Committee that Mel was over in on the Hill. And so she was one of a dozen interns that summer that met with him and helped him on various things. And he was impressed with her, and he did keep up the relationship for years. In fact, he actually encouraged her at one point to run for Moynihan's seat from New York long before that became public.
And she is now the U.S. Senator from New York. What I got out of your book was that Mel Laird, in a lot of ways, was very instrumental in developing the intellectual foundation for the modern Republican Party. He worked with think tanks like the American Enterprise Institute and the Heritage Foundation to become counterweights to the liberal think tanks like the Brookings Institute. He came out with the conservative papers in 1964 as a counterweight to the liberal papers, which were being studied by college students all across America at that time. And he also hammered out a very difficult platform negotiation for the Republican Party in 1964 at their convention at the Cow Palace in San Francisco between the Barry Goldwater faction on the right and the Nelson Rockefeller faction on the left. That was no mean feat during that convention.
No, it was a very difficult thing. And, I should just say, Glenn, your summary at the top of the program was just excellent. A lot of people have not picked that up. That 64 election was a turning point for the Republican Party. It was after that election, after he was trying to hammer out a compromise and didn't get as much through as he wanted, although he was the head of the platform committee. Goldwater came out of that convention. They were severely drubbed, the Republicans, that year. A lot of Republicans lost their seats in Congress and in the Senate. And that's why in January 65, when they come back, he, being just behind Jerry Ford and promoting Jerry Ford, overthrew the minority leader and put Jerry Ford into the position of being the minority leader of the House with Mel as his number two, and changing the thinking. That's when they, it was that year that they started opposing Johnson on the Vietnam War. And doing a number of initiatives that were pretty impressive, including, as you mentioned, spawning Mel, very significantly spawning every serious Republican think tank we now have, except for the Hoover Institute, which preceded him, but American Enterprise Institute, Heritage Foundation, CSIS, name any of them, and Mel was involved in their formation or as they developed.
Oh, and Mel was very instrumental also in making the Republican Party what it was, and we wish it were that way today because of his nonpartisanship and working across the aisle with Fogarty and with Nelson and with others. He was in a minority, but he was able to accomplish so much for medicine, healthcare, research, because he had this huge credibility with Democrats as well as Republicans, and had written that thesis for the Republican Party, which they have now put in the wastepaper basket and would rather fight than make love.
You know, I always saw it, Bob and Glenn, as a gift from Wisconsin. I always considered Mel kind of a progressive Republican, and that kind of a thing. Wisconsin had such a history of these giants of both parties, La Follette and Gaylord Nelson and others, who knew what was best not just for Wisconsin but for the country.
Well, when Melvin Laird was a young man, the Republican Party was being molded by two very significant, powerful national figures, or at least the memories of them. And you couldn't think of more disparate people. You had Bob La Follette on the one hand and Joe McCarthy on the other. And Mr. Laird apparently didn't have a very high opinion of Mr. McCarthy.
No, he didn't. And I didn't mention McCarthy on my list. So that was an aberration for Wisconsin. He was a grandstander, self-aggrandizing. And
a drunk.
And drank a lot, yes. And so Mel and Ford and other Republicans often kept some distance from him. They knew what he was doing, and that it was potentially, it was the potential destruction of the Republican Party. It was always interesting to me when we mentioned the influence of his mother. It was his mother that fought McCarthy on the convention floor in the 50s. And won. He tried to seat some of his own delegates or something, and she won. And it was his mother who instinctively thought Nixon was not trustworthy and that Mel shouldn't work for him as Secretary of Defense, but he had already agreed to do so. So those were some cases he really did trust his mother's instincts, but kind of had to do things for the sake of the country.
We've only got a couple of minutes left here, but where was Mel Laird during the whole Watergate situation and during Nixon's resignation?
When he was in the Pentagon, he made a rule that anybody from Nixon's office that wanted to see him could not summon him to Nixon's office. He could summon them, or they could get his secretary. The president had to call Mel to get him to come across the Potomac to the White House. And that's what kept the Pentagon and Mel out of Watergate. Can you imagine what would have happened if they had gotten involved in that swindling mess? It would have just destroyed the Pentagon, the Army, and the Navy, and Mel kept them safe.
Without knowing that Watergate was going on, he just instinctively knew he couldn't trust the operatives around Nixon, Haldeman and Ehrlichman and others. That's why he set up this rule from the beginning to say, every contact with the White House is going to go through my guy, Carl Wallace, a Wisconsinite that had been his chief of staff, or myself, or Bob Froehlich at one point, because he trusted all of them. And that did, I mean, Liddy came by one day and was turned away at the door. But he didn't know this was going on. However, he knew that they couldn't be trusted. Later, he worked in the White House as domestic counselor. When he found out Nixon was guilty, he made sure Gerry Ford became vice president and eventually president.
He had good instincts, and he knew who was trustworthy, and those were the people that he kept as his friends and his associates.
And a reporter asked Mel, did you know that President Ford would be President Ford when you made him vice president? And he said, sure I did. How did you know? Because I knew that Nixon had lied and that he would be out of office.
Gentlemen, we are out of time. We want to thank today's guests, author Dale Van Atta, who joined us by telephone from Washington, D.C., and Bob Williams of Idea Associates of Stevens Point. A reminder that Van Atta's great book on Melvin Laird, With Honor, Melvin Laird on War, Peace, and Politics, is available at your local bookstore. I'm Glenn Mulbrick of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks to our executive producer, Rick Ryer, and our on-air producer, Jane Ritger. Thanks to all of you who called in with your questions and comments, and thanks as always to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. Route 51 can be heard every Thursday at 5 o'clock on the Ideas Network. Thanks again for riding with us today. Until next week, we are heading out of town.